There we go.
There's
that
lady.
So as we enter into, as we continue our study of Matthew, the church has joined us in the sense that following Pentecost, now we begin the reading of Matthew liturgically. And this is going to carry us probably to mid to late October. So this time of the year, from early summer, sometimes late spring, depending when Pascha falls, it's a good chunk of the year we study Matthew. Mark also, Mark more on the weekdays, almost all of the weekend meeting readings, especially Sunday, are going to be Matthew. So you'll be hearing the deacons say the reading according to Matthew for the next several months. And actually last, what was it, Monday or Tuesday, I think we had the Beatitudes. So we're almost aligned where we are liturgically. The other thing I want to share with you is I'm on a task force with the Archdiocese. There's a core team and several dozen others that are revamping all of our ministries to the youth, Christian education, youth, camping, all this together, young adults. And we're going to try to coordinate curriculum across the programs together. And when we're trying to find a book of the Bible to start with, guess which book they chose?
Matthew.
That's right. So we're going to get a lot of Matthew, thankfully, in the next couple of years.
Why did they choose Matthew, Father?
What's that?
Why did they choose Matthew?
A lot of the same reasons we talked about. We were talking about whether we want to go back and restart and all that. It's such a foundational book. There's a reason it's the first book of the New Testament. It's so comprehensive. It's just all the same reasons. They said, Matthew is where we have to begin. I mean, the church said it when we set up the canon. We've been saying it ever since. You got to start with Matthew. Now, it's interesting, as far as entering the church, John is the first gospel
right.
That's read liturgically after the new catechumens are baptized and chrismated.
Right.
But that's not where their education began. It just meant that the church could not teach them John, which is much more theological. And so John comes first after chrismation, after baptism and chrismation. But they would have studied the other gospels before that. So it's interesting. Huh. Yeah. Matthew is primary in so many ways. St. John Chrysostom's commentaries on Matthew are huge. He goes into great depth in Matthew. So we're in the middle again of the Sermon on the Mount. We had the Beatitudes. We had the first couple sayings after that. Last week we spent a great deal of time talking about not abolishing the law but fulfilling it. And that's such an important concept. That's why we spent so much time on it. That if we miss that concept, you're going to miss Matthew. You're going to miss the main teachings, which really are about what it means that Christ has not abolished the law, but fulfilled it. And by the way, also, if you notice liturgically, if you're reading your daily readings, the church goes to Romans. So the first of the epistles, first of the gospel, first of the epistles, after Pentecost. And Romans picks up this theme really in a very interesting way in chapter 1, where at the same time St. Paul is telling us, it's there's the newness in Christ, he goes into very clearly saying it doesn't mean that we do whatever we want, and even gives some very specific examples of how we should not live if we're living the righteous life. So again, it's a very important thing to understand, which again, because many modern people hearing the Christian gospel, misunderstand it to say what we do doesn't matter. And what we're going to see right now is my introduction to this is it's not only what you do that matters, why you do it and what happens beneath what you're doing also matters. So we're going to get to, we've talked about the importance of the heart. We'll get to that now. So let's see. I think we left off.
27,
is that right? There we go. Yeah, we heard the examples of anger, leaving your own gift at the altar. We heard about that last time. So let's pick up. If somebody would read for us 27 to 32, please.
somebody volunteers. Okay, I'll go.
Thank you, Maria.
You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart.
How about to a man?
If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery.
Okay, so last week we asked and answered the question, is Christ increasing the requirements going from the Old Testament to the New, or what we call the New Covenant? Is he increasing or decreasing?
Sounds like he's increasing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we talked a little about this last week. Part of it is he gets to not only intention, but thought. And we spent some time talking about the process of temptation. It's not a sin to have temptation come to you. When we start to engage in that, play with it, plan on it, imagine it, then already, as Christ is saying, we are already committing the sin. I want to talk for a few minutes about adultery, because he goes straight from his examples earlier of the new law. He talked about killing, being angry, having things against people. Now he mentions adultery. And I think it's really important we understand why adultery is, or the sexual sins are always so prominent. A lot of people will say, well, you Christians, you're obsessed with sex, right? And they don't understand why. Even most Christians, I don't think, understand why. Let me hear some guesses first. Why would sexual sin, adultery being one of them, be such a prominent thing, do you think, in God's commandments?
Is it because the two are united as one?
Good.
Get married.
Good.
I think it has something to do with we're made in the image of God, and that we are you know, his vessels, and he lives within us. So I guess anything we do that's immoral sexually is directly related to him.
Yeah, you guys are right on target. It's not a comparison of sexual sin versus other sin. It's the importance and the primacy of our physical bodies and the sexual act as a reflection of something that is not human, but is actually divine. Right? So we have lots of images of how God relates to us. Some of the images we hear in the New Testament, you know, Christ says, I'm the good shepherd, I'm the door. He talks about himself in different ways. But one example that goes throughout the scriptures, literally Genesis to Revelation, is the image of a husband and wife. And you hear a lot about this in Holy Week. We have three or four, depending on the tradition, bridegroom matins. We talk about Christ as a bride, as a groom, and the church as the bride of Christ. So it really comes down to the fact that that union, the sexual union and the marriage as a whole, really is a reflection of God. What you both said there is exactly right on target. That's why when we mess up that image, it's not just messing up a human image. We're messing up, as you mentioned, Rick, in the image of God, and specifically the image of relationship between God and us and God and his creation. What's the sin of leaving a life of faith or leaving the church? What do we call that?
Heresy?
Heresy, close. Heresy is, yeah, when you teach something that causes a division of the church, that's close. Starts so with an A.
Is it apostasy?
Apostasy, okay. Apostasy, if you look at the early canons of the church, so many of them dealt with apostasy. Can people who leave the church come back? Yes. What are the conditions under which that they left? Might they come back? What are the conditions of bringing them back? Because that relationship is seen as such a vital relationship that we don't take it as just you can come and go, right? That would not only affect the relationship of the church, it reflects their reflection of God's relationship with us, right? Coming and going from the church means that you can come and go from your relationship with God. It doesn't work that way. Why? Because he's a jealous God. He's a loving God and a jealous God. He wants that union, which is not one where, you know, people come and go. So you're going to hear a lot about sexual sin in not only the Gospels, but in the life of the church. And that's one of the main reasons why. The other related to that is that because of that high calling of that relationship, sexual sins tend to be more damaging spiritually. So we don't have, you know, big sins and little sins in the church. We don't have, we don't rate them as the Catholic Church will do it later on. They would have, what is it? Mortal. And
venial.
Venial. Are the only two? Are there others?
I think so.
Okay. So we never did that in the Eastern Church. However, we understood very clearly that certain sins were more deadly in the sense that they were more damaging.
Yeah.
An image I would use with the kids at camp is, if I go to the emergency room and I have a cut, I have a laceration, that could be as small as a paper cut, or I could have, forgive the grossness, but my arm almost cut off. It may be called a laceration. So there's sin and there's sin, and there's injury and there's injury. Both are injuries, as a sin is always, it could be damaging, but some tend to be more damaging than others. Not always, but tend to be. And that's another reason, because that relationship is such a reflection of God, that the marring of it can be so damaging, which is why we can see in the world, it's not that the Christians are obsessed with sex. It's the non-Christians who, in many, many circumstances, have really changed sexuality, especially in the last 50, 60 years. And we see that as a huge problem because of what it does to the image of God's relationship with us. One question that's come to us, most of you probably know, I write for the Grand Rapids Press. There's a panel of ethics and religion writers, and we answer a question from each of our perspectives. And so that question has come about homosexuality. This is where I'm focusing my answer. It's not just about it being a dirty, gross thing. It's about God has given us our gender identity in marriage as a reflection of his relationship with us. And so when you mess that up, again, you mess up the image. So I just wanted to say that in terms of why adultery would be such an important thing to bring out. Questions or thoughts on that?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt somebody?
Go ahead, Susie.
I often noted that in the Orthodox Church, divorce wasn't viewed, at least in the way I've been taught, it doesn't appear to be viewed the same way in all the other churches, different denominations. We seem to understand maybe the youthfulness and the immaturity and decision-making process of younger people, and that we have somehow understood reasons for divorce. And I was taught, like, maybe we accept the first divorce, maybe we even accept the second, but the third is a bridge too far. But this passage about, you know, you leave your wife, you're unfaithful to her, and then you leave her in a state of adultery herself. If you divorce and then she pursues another relationship, that just puts somebody's pain on her, you know what I mean, or on him, whoever it may be, and right. somebody's sin on her. So is the church saying that once there's a divorce, there should be celibacy for the, let's just say, the abandoned spouse? Or I don't fully understand. I just know that it seems like they've created a sinful situation, or someone did, and somebody else is paying the price for it too.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because in the context of what I was saying earlier, you'll understand why. The church is always going to hold up one marriage as the ideal.
Right.
And as we do in a lot of situations, even if we allow certain things that we don't think are good, we will sometimes allow it for the laity, but not for the clergy. So, for example, a priest, even a priest's wife, typically is not allowed to remarry after the death of a spouse, not only a divorce, but even death. The idea is that you maintain the ideal, even in an unideal situation. So it doesn't mean that God can't do something about it, but for the clergy, at least, the idea is they uphold that idea. Now, for the laity, use the word that we understand it. I would say that we understand the weakness, and therefore, out of accommodation, we do allow a second or third marriage. But it's not out of approval in the ideal sense. And in fact, some of you may have witnessed this. If you go to a wedding of, and depending, it's used differently in different archdioceses, but typically if both spouses have been married before, it's a slightly different wedding service that is somewhat penitential. Talking about that this marriage, even though it's a blessing, it's out of the weakness of the participants that it's being celebrated. So we both acknowledge the ideal and the accommodation in the service. It's one that some priests don't do, I would say, out of fear, because it's not all happy and joy. I mean, there's most of it's the same, but there is a sense of that this is an accommodation. The church is saying, we will bless this marriage, God will bless this marriage, but it's not the ideal. Yeah. So yeah, we allow it, Susie, but we allow it out of our weakness. We don't allow it out of saying, well, it's not important or it's not a big deal. It's out of our weakness.
So Father, that sounds really so very special that we can view things that way. Then I need to just take it the next step. And that is, I think our younger generation, our millennial generation that grew up with a, you know, strong education and heavily, heavily influenced and attacked by society, maybe yep. they would wonder why we don't view other things that way, accommodating the weakness without me specifying, you know, but I know that these are struggles that the millennial generation has. All the studies show it too, you know, the different ways that maybe our boomer generation responds to things compared to our millennial generation and subsequent generations after that. I just ask you about that a bit, because—
Well, I would say that we do almost everything by accommodation. Now, we don't accommodate everything, but we there is so much of what we do is by accommodation. I'll give you one example. Missing liturgy 3 weeks is an automatic excommunication. It's a self-excommunication. Can you imagine if we applied that strictly?
Wow. Amazing.
You know, the fasting requirements, all the things that the church says, this is how you live. And then I would say we put up with almost everything. But again, this is where as a church, we're always finding that balance. If we put up with everything, then what we're, there's no meaning left. There's no truth left.
Then what do we believe? Yeah.
Right, exactly. So we have to accommodate, but always, hopefully, without setting a new standard. This is so tricky. I'll use the issue that you all heard me talk about last time I got here. Coming late to church, right? To come late to church, no one is going to, I don't think anyone would say it's good, right? But people will say things like, well, as long as you come before the gospel, you can take communion.
Yeah.
Right? That's sort of a general rule people have heard.
Yeah.
But, right. But
what an awful thing.
Yeah.
You know? So what do? Do we stand at the door and time people? You know, obviously we don't want to live in a church like that. We definitely don't judge each other, by the way. And this is what Romans, one of the genius of Romans in chapter one, is that St. Paul starts out almost immediately laying out like, hey, if you're doing these things, you're not going to enter the kingdom. And then he turns around in the second part of that chapter and is like, hey, if you're judging those people, you're not going to enter the kingdom. So none of this is about, we don't judge as individuals. This is where it's hard for a lot of us to understand. When the church sets a standard, it's not a judgment. That's like saying you go to the doctor and you want an antibiotic and he says no, and you go, well, stop judging me. You know, the doctor's there to cure you according to his expertise. The church is there for the same reason, but sometimes we look at, if the church were to example to say no, we look at it as, well, I'm being judged.
Right.
When really, it's the church caring for you. And the most strong example of this is, on the very rare occasion, somebody would approach the chalice and the priest would hopefully very kindly and quietly say, you know, please take a piece of holy bread and we'll talk after. You know, I did that once to somebody who, it was a misunderstanding. They told me what they wanted to do before they came to communion. They wanted to have confession first. They hadn't done it. They came to communion. I was confused. I said, why don't you take a piece of bread? We'll talk after. And I didn't know it, but that started a big conversation in the back of the church. People who didn't know the situation, and I was getting phone calls and messages, and people want to talk after church. And I kept saying, A, you don't know the situation, and B, it's not about judging anybody. That was out of care. You know, communion is, St. Basil says, it's a fire consuming the unworthy. So it's out of love if we withhold, that's the word people use, is withhold the sacrament. But you're right, it's a very tough thing for our kids, or really all of us in some ways, understand. Where do you draw those lines? And they're not clear.
And really, Father, I think that's something that would benefit us all, especially that younger generation, if our church could make it clear. You know, because yeah. I think once they hear the explanation, they can understand that it's not judgment, you know, that it's not condemnation on our part and so on and so forth, you know.
Yeah.
So somehow I think our trigger words for him. But Father, just one other thing, and forgive me, it's just because this has come up in some discussion.
Sure.
When there is a divorce in the church, in the Catholic mm-hmm. Church, we are widely aware of annulments and so on and so forth. In the Orthodox, and sometimes an exchange of money, which some people think is you know, I don't want to say uncouth, but what's the word I want to? Yeah, Father,
like buying indulgence.
Maybe unholy, you know.
Right.
But can you explain that, where if someone is seeking a divorce, and whether that means an annulment or a divorce? Is there a requirement for some kind of a payment to be made?
Yeah, let me get to that second. I forget, remind me. But on the first issue, the annulment, both the Orthodox and the Catholic churches have the same goal in mind. And the goal is to preserve that image of the one man, one woman, in a marriage because it reflects what we've talked about before, God's relationship with us. So that's right. The goal of both. What the Catholic Church did is to preserve that one. If there's going to be another, they say the first one didn't happen.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, on a rational, I've never understood how you ration, but I'm sure they have, you know, in their own mind, a good argument for it.
What but we even say, with children, even with children, you know what I mean?
Right. Right. And I don't know how children. That works, but yeah, you annul the marriage so that you, the person can have their one and only marriage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have the same rule as us. You can have three, but I don't know how they counted if the first didn't happen, but anyway, the goal is the same. I don't want to criticize them because our goal is the same.
No.
The way we do it is again, out of,
accommodation.
Thank you. Out of accommodation, we will recognize that a marriage has ended. Now, there's two ways that it happens. One is civilly. And then when that the divorce is brought to the church, the church has to decide, will they also recognize the divorce and recognize that the marriage has ended? And this is where a process, and the process is very similar in the Orthodox and Catholic churches in theory. In practice, it's very different. But they both go to a spiritual court.
Right.
Because the idea is no one person, even especially a priest, really doesn't have the authority, because of the importance of preserving that image, of saying this marriage can be, or the divorce can be recognized.
Yeah.
Right. So it goes to a spiritual court. How that works in the Catholic Church, I think, is much more involved than ours. And I give them credit for that. I mean, I've had complaints from people who say they have to go. It's very embarrassing. It's very uncomfortable. And why I understand that, I also understand the goal, which is to not just let a marriage either end or annul it, depending which side you're on, easily. From our side, what happens, and different archdioceses do these differently, the participants in the marriage that's now failed don't typically go before the court. And the court is typically a group of priests or a bishop with two priests, typically it's three people, who review documentation from the local priest, who says, here's the situation, here's the couple, here's what happened that causes the trouble. Here's what they tried. And having tried everything, you know, the letter is coming from me as a priest or the local priest saying, at this point, our recommendation is to recognize that the marriage has failed and has ended. And after an appropriate period of penance, that the person or persons be restored to communion. Because it's seen as a sin so damaging that the person has to spend some time in penitence that involves not receiving Holy Communion. It's not the only one, by the way, that does that. That's why people often think it's singled out. It's just the one that requires, it cannot be controlled at the local level. In other words, I can't reinstate someone from that. I can reinstate them from all kinds of penances, but not that one.
So, Father, are there costs incurred then, you know, for the time of the meeting, paperwork, things like that?
There's nothing in the tradition that has that. But in our archdiocese, I don't know if it was Metropolitan Philip First. It might have been Metropolitan Anthony, I'm not sure. But it continues under Metropolitan Joseph. That in addition to all the documentation being forwarded, they ask for a filing fee. I can tell you, and this is on the internet, but I'll say it anyway. I personally don't think that that's accomplishing anything. I think it brings a lot of confusion to the process in that people think you're quote unquote paying for the divorce.
Right.
It's explained in full to say that this is a filing fee. There are actual material costs. You got to bring these clergy together. You've got to, you know, there's time taken to review all these. We have now 300 church and archdiocese. So imagine it's not a small number, sadly. But my personal thought is that I wish that would change. because I think it's a very confusing thing in the middle of a very confusing process already. But especially, it still stands.
Especially if it keeps somebody, Father, from, you know, kind of following through to be able to return to church.
It's never anything like that. I mean, I think it's $200 or something. It's nothing that somebody couldn't afford. And if people can't, there are accommodations for that. That's never seen as a requirement.
Right.
It's requested. It's not required. I have paid it for people because I didn't want to introduce the confusion. But in obedience, for what I can't decide and judge the bishop and say it's wrong. So I can have my opinion on it, but my job is to obey. So that's where that is.
Father?
Yeah.
In the late 70s, I went through a divorce, and that whole process was interesting.
Yeah.
First of all, the reasons, there were like half a dozen reasons where it would be okay to divorce. And I found them strange. If your spouse abandoned you for X amount of years, or if the spouse was in prison for X amount of time, or if there was a sexual problem.
And right.
I said to my local priest, none of the above. Well, you have to choose one. So he suggested that I talk to the bishop. And the bishop was surprised that I wanted the divorce so quickly because I had the civil divorce. And I said, well, Your Grace, in the eyes of God, I'm Maria Jodis, and I want to be able to take communion. Yes. So I guess he was impressed with that. And I couldn't go to the ecclesiastical court because I was having major surgery. Okay. And so there was $100, and this was back in the 70s, $100 cost for them to fill out the paperwork, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then they gave me the divorce. But, you know, it was mental abuse, but that was at that time, that was not acceptable.
Yeah, and I would say that's up to the local bishop. I don't think we have a list of acceptable criteria.
And
some bishops do, ours don't, but right.
Maybe they don't today, because that was how many years ago.
That's my guess too. And you can see how we've recovered our tradition. When, you know, back in the 70s, and I would say even in the early 80s, there was a thought of this process not accompanying the divorce, but the desire for remarriage. In other words, the most standard time to do is when the person wanted to remarry. And that always confused me. Because like you're saying, you want to be restored to communion. You don't want to wait to get married to go back to communion. But back then, communion was so infrequent that for a lot of people, it wasn't a big deal that they were out of communion.
Interesting.
So it's a sign of growth now that we do this much more associated with the divorce than the next marriage, if there's going to be one. Yeah.
I wish our priests would enlighten us about the information we're sharing. Like what we talked about earlier about being on time to church and, you know, missing X amount of Sundays because people don't know.
Right.
And they're lackadaisical. Yeah. I know in our church, I grew up with, it's Greek time. That's why I'm late.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes it okay. Yeah, we have the same thing. We have Arab time.
Yeah.
I've been doing some looking up for specific reasons, and I agree with Maria that we don't do a good job in communicating, at least I haven't seen it, of, and I don't want to say rules and regulations, but how we receive the sacraments, how we have to prepare for the sacraments. I think the Greek Archdiocese does a really nice job in explaining marriage and godparenting. Who has to be married? Like, to be married in the Greek church, both people have to be baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in water. They don't have to be, only one has to be Orthodox. Or how do you become a godparent? And I don't think a lot of that is left to the local priest or the local bishop to decide, and that's what gets people confused. I think we need to have a document that says, you know, what constitutes being buried through the from the church versus the funeral home, you know.
Well, I think you're up front. Yep, you're absolutely right, Alan. One of my hopes is that soon we're going to start a project, and maybe somebody on this in this Bible study might be coordinating that. But my goal is that we have, for lack of a better term, a handbook that addresses every aspect of life in the church, from, you know, eligibility for communion and preparing for communion and preparing for confession, and even practically, when does the priest hear confessions? How do I arrange my confession? If I'm going to be a godparent, what's required of me? All of those things, I think, would be great. And my goal is that we do it in such a way that other churches could take it and just adapt it. I had this in Bowling Green, my last parish, because they were mostly new Orthodox. And they didn't know things like, when you go to the hospital, you call the priest. You know, I mean, even today, a lot of our Orthodox people don't know that. I have to tell the parents when they have children, when you have your child, you let me know, and I'm not on your visiting list when you're feeling better. I'm there the first day because you're not feeling good. We're there. The church is there from day one to bless your child, to bless the mother, to pray for her good health and recovery. But you're right. So much of this, we people don't really know, you know, and then when they find out, it's typically sometimes too late. I can't tell you how many times I've had to deal with the fact that somebody asked someone to be a godparent, and then they come to me and they say, well, here are the godparents. What's that, Alan?
No, someone's here. I got to put you on mute for a minute.
Okay. And you then know, you have to backtrack and say, well, here's the requirements, you know, but they just didn't know.
Because, you know, Father, sometimes the intermarriages with the interfaith, and they might have a sister of the husband, you know, who's going to be the right godmother. But in the Orthodox Church, if it's a daughter, it has to be, you know, an Orthodox right godmother, you know, things exactly like that. But they're trying to honor their siblings, you exactly know, or their cousins. So I can see where that difficulty comes in, you know.
Well, right. I think it could be the same, a similar situation in a marriage when they have the best man chosen and they, right, they have to have an Orthodox sponsor.
Right, exactly. And it's even more difficult now, Susie, not just the intermarriage, but they assume that because their brother or sister cousin was baptized, they are Orthodox.
Right.
And I say, well, who is this person? Oh, that's my sister. She lives down the street. And I go, I've never met her. Well, she hasn't been to church in a couple years, meaning sometimes a couple decades.
Right.
And that's the person they want to sponsor. Then, but you're right. When people understand, when the way it's explained, they understand it. So I was having a conversation with somebody about sponsorship. And I said, if somebody wants to join the Cascade Hills Country Club, am I allowed to sponsor them? They said, well, are you a member? I said, no. Well, then you can't. I said, why can't I? Well, you're not a member. I said, so what? What if I want to? What do they want me as their sponsor? Well, you can't really vouch for them to the members. You can't explain how things work. So they get it in other situations. We just have to understand that a sponsor is doing the same thing in baptism as joining a club or any other thing where sponsorship is org. They get it in those contexts. They just need to understand that it works the same way in the church. How is somebody going to be a godparent to a young child in the church when that person is involved? They were baptized themselves. That's like saying, well, I was a member of the country club 30 years ago, and now I want to sponsor somebody. I haven't been around for 30 years. They're going to say no. Rightly yeah so.
Interesting you know analogy, Father. Father, yeah, just a quick question on what you're saying, and I think you're referring to the strategic planning that's slated for the church. But why do you think the archdiocese hasn't developed such a manual? Because then it would go throughout, you know, the whole church.
It's a very good question. Even the clergy guide, Metropolitan Philip used to always keep updated a clergy guide. And the last edition is 2011. And we're still using it, but you know, a lot of things change. So we're hoping, and I hear there's a new clergy guide coming out, and the clergy guide says like when you can marry people, when you're not allowed to baptize, who's a voting member of the church, things like that. So a lot of it is in there, not all of it. I think part of the problem of the archdiocese, especially in ours, it's easy for the people in the archdiocese level to think on that level and not always think about what the parishes need. Right. This is what we're talking about with our youth ministry programs, is there's a lot of good programs, but most of them, I shouldn't say most of them, too many of them in the past have not been parish-based. You know, you have Teen Soil and they do the Bible Bowl and the oratorio. Those are great. And yeah, they come from the parish. We need things in the parish on a regular basis to help teach the faith for our kids. We've been wanting for 20 years new curriculum for Sunday school, still waiting for that. So yeah, we have to do a much better job of supporting the local parish.
Father, is there something that guidelines for a presbytera, the priest's wife?
No, not that I've seen anyway. Talk about a gaping hole of support and direction. Yeah, Vicki gave a call to Sarah, who I've only met now over phone calls and Zoom. She'll be our new youth director's wife. And someday, you know, God willing, maybe soon, even a priest's wife. But, you know, there's like next to nothing. There's, you know, in terms of like some, you know, documentation or training or... what's helpful is that at the seminary, the seminarians' wives form some bonds, and as they kind of go out, they stay connected to each other and they help each other out. There are presbytera and Juria groups on Facebook. Those have been helpful. People say, hey, this is going on. How have you handled this kind of situation? But I'll say too, the Greek Archdiocese there also has done a nice job of starting to address that. In fact, Father Joshua at Over Holy Trinity, where Maria's at, his mother is on serves on a department that one of their main focuses is support of clergy families. So the clergy specifically, the priest's wife and the kids individually, but then the family as a whole too. So they're starting to do a lot of really good work to support. You know, it's just a sign that it's getting in some ways more challenging to do everything as a Christian, even for the clergy and their families. It's getting more difficult.
Someone said it'd be easy, Father.
What's that?
That nobody said it'd be easy.
Yeah.
There.
That's right.
And what have you said? If it's easy, Alan, it's not work.
Alan has to get off.
All right, we'll see you, Alan.
Okay.
Bye, Alan. Bye.
Yeah, we've got to wrap this up, but I want to just cover this part because I don't want to let it go, because it's always confusing to people. This thing about if your eye causes you to sin, pluck out and throw it away. What do you think? Is that literal?
What's that?
No.
No.
What do you say?
The plucking out of an eye that causes you to sin.
So what's the meaning?
My study note says Jesus is not teaching self-mutilation. For even a blind man can lust. The point is that we should deal as drastically with sin as necessary.
There we go. In fact, you may or may not know this. One of the most prolific writers in the early church was a man named Origen. And although he did have some problems with theology, one of the reasons why he was not consecrated as a saint is he took this literally, and he had lust issues. He took this verse literally, and the church condemned him for it.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mean he plucked out his eye?
He emasculated himself.
That's That's a good term.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah. So it is not to be, it is not, as the subdeacon read, not a, an okay for mutilation of the body. I'll read you one quote very similar to that. It's from Apollinaris, who says, he speaks about the numbers of the body, but employs hyperbole. It is not that one should literally cut off one's members. Rather, one is called to mortify them and render them useless for sin, as the apostle has said. One should not spare even things that thought most necessary if through them any bad activity threatens to occur. So he's trying to elevate, again, the danger of sin. And again, keeping in our goal here of trying to understand what is Matthew sharing us throughout the whole book about what this new covenant is.
Yeah.
And we can see, again, it's not a decrease, it's an increase.
Coley?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Subdeacon Nicholas. When you read that description or explanation, did you say deal with sin extremely? Was the word extremely?
The point is, it says here, the point is that we should deal as drastically with sin as necessary.
Because plucking out an eye or emasculating oneself would be
drastic,
wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
But I think what the other quote is kind of modifying is saying that drasticness isn't necessarily limited to the, in other words, like physical. He says, you can lust without your eye. So the casting out the eye is not, that's not at the end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. He's trying to say, go drastic. And the most drastic is what? What is the member that needs to be corrected more than any other?
The brain.
brain, but the heart, in the sense that the brain is where the thinking happens.
Right.
What our fathers have taught us is that it's the brain outside of the heart is what they would call insanity.
Wow.
So the whole goal of the Christian life is to get the brain back to its rightful home in the heart, in the center of where we are, where God dwells. So if you can change the eye, you can change the members, it's the heart that has to be converted. It's the heart that has to be purified and cleansed. And even, you know, there's this idea of what they call the noose, which is often called the eye of the heart. You've got to cleanse that. If that is dirty, if that's stained, if it's clouded, you can't see, not just physically, you can't see clearly. And so all of our spiritual efforts, not performing sin is important, but that's not the end of the process. That's towards the beginning. We can do that cleansing from the outside in, getting the heart and the eye of the heart to be clear and focusing on what's, as St. Paul tells us, what is good, true, and beautiful.
Did you hear what Rick said?
No.
What did you call it, Rick?
I said the thing that
the brain
without a heart, I call that my laptop computer.
Nice. There you go. Well, thank you, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you, Father. Everybody have a good summer till we meet.
You too. Keep reading your Bibles. Don't stop reading just because we're not doing the study. And we'll pick up with where we are in Matthew towards the end of the summer, early fall.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Father.
God bless you all.
Good to see everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay.